You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomas on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hello, I'm Scott King.
And I'm Joe Tursty. We host the KBOO podcast, the King Tursty Music Hour. Every month, we upload a new show to our KBOO website. We currently have over 80 shows available for you to listen and enjoy.
Each of our shows is based on a different theme. Enjoy great music as well as our discussion of the songs and artists. Our show is rock, soul, and blues based, but you might hear anything, including country, jazz, and classical.
The easiest way to find us is to simply enter King Tursty Music Hour into your web browser and select it with the KBOO FM extension. That's King, K-I-N-G, Tursty, T-U-R-S-I, Music Hour.
While you're there, check out our wide variety of shows. We've got shows on social issues, musical themes, people, the holidays, and so much more.
That's the King Tursty Music Hour on KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Genocide Watch, our weekly update on the U.S. armed genocide against Gaza and the West Bank with Flashpoint special contributor Sam Husseini. Today, Sam and I will be joined by activist attorney Robert Jureski, who recently led Code Pink's World Court Project. We'll keep an eye on the genocide and another eye on what's going on at the United Nations as it opens for business again. Also, senior producer Kevin Pina on the real politics regarding Venezuela and Haiti. And poet and translator, psychotherapist Anita Barrows is back with poem 717 on the 717th day of the Gaza genocide. This and a lot more coming up. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We begin our show, as we do every Monday, with our special segment. We call it Genocide Watch. And of course, we're talking about, at this point, the U.S. armed and supported ongoing genocide in Gaza and the West Bank. Let's not forget the West Bank, 8 times the size of Gaza and under siege and attack as well. Joining us, as he does every week, and we appreciate him, is Sam Husseini. He is a special contributor to this program and has been doing some great work for us when we can manage to track down State Department people having a meeting and ask him a question or two. Sam, welcome back to Flashpoints. Gotta start, as we always do, with Gaza. Dozens more killed. There is no end to the killing. It worries me, Sam, that people are getting hard to the level of violence, because I'm hearing less and less talk about it in the corporate mainstream. Not like there was much there to begin with.
There's been a complete normalization of genocide, which is an appalling thing to say. I think that there have been systematic ways that that's been done by the establishment. They put in a phony ceasefire that was designed to fail just as Trump was coming into office, so that the media lens would shift off of Gaza to the extent that it was there and onto Trump and his, you know, he's just a distraction machine a good deal of the time. Israeli forces have killed at least 61 Palestinians in Gaza over the last 24 hours. Trump just prepared a $6 billion additional weapons package for Israel, paid for by your U.S. tax dollars. The U.S. is disputing that its citizens were killed in Lebanon. It won't even stand by some citizens when it comes to Israel over and over again. Last Thursday evening, I believe, the U.S. Issued its sixth veto of a ceasefire resolution at the U.N. Security Council. which kind of brings us to the, you know, coming UN, the big high-level meetings. It's the 80th session of the UN Security Council coming up, opening tomorrow. I'm going to be on with Craig Mochaber, who's been on this program, and a couple of other great folks, some volunteers at StopGenocide.com are organizing a live stream so that we can sort of debunk what different what Trump, he'll be the second, or the second speaker from a nation state to speak tomorrow morning, but a whole bunch of other speakers are going to speak. You'll have the UN Secretary General speaking. He has refused to call Israel's genocide a genocide. I just watched a good chunk of a speech that he made today in which he can't even bring himself to say Israel. He just simply says, oh, these terrible things are happening in Gaza, without naming the perpetrator. He has no problem naming Hamas as the perpetrator of the October 7th attacks, mind you, but he has a hard time getting it out of his mouth that Israel is slaughtering people on a daily basis. And he has not, as a matter of policy, he's refused to say the word genocide, even after the recent UN commission put out a fairly strong report. I think it had some flaws, but it was a fairly strong report, and it basically urged UN officials to use the term genocide, and it also reminded all UN member states that they were put on notice the moment that South Africa filed its lawsuit at the International Court of Justice invoking the Genocide Convention, and then when the ICJ issued its provisional orders in January of 2024, all of these countries were put on notice that they were under a legal obligation under the Genocide Convention. It's a convention to punish and prevent genocide. It's a special convention in that sense. It puts a moral, it puts a legal obligation, not just a moral obligation, a legal obligation on states, on states to act, and they haven't acted. Some have issued good statements, but you know, if you go through the record of, you know, country after country, they have not done what they need to, what they need to do. I don't know if we have Rob with us. He's done incredible work on this.
We do, but I just want to say one other thing about the bottom line before we take our spotlight off the direct suffering. I think we have to keep repeating the brutality that surrounds this so-called, they call it a feeding program. It's a starvation program in which Palestinians are drawn into a crossfire and then murdered without any questions being asked. It is an extraordinary situation that they can continue to use food as bait and then they use the Palestinians as target practice. This continues.
Absolutely. And you see report after report from doctors in Gaza saying how, you know, they're having, you know, children that are dying of headshots. I've even seen some reports from doctors that, like, on a given day, you know, it's headshots, and on another day it's groin shots, and another day it's chest shots. So it's like they're doing target practice on each day. Like, you know, the so-called soldiers are saying, what body part will we hit today? They're obviously using food as a weapon. They're starving the people of Gaza, and they're, you know, some of their right-wing ministers are outright saying hip hip hooray. They've detained, you know, imprisoned doctors, heads of hospitals, and so on. They've decimated virtually every hospital in Gaza. It's clearly a systematic genocide, and that's been clear for some time. I think some people are acknowledging it now very belatedly, sort of as a, you know, attempt to wash their hands of it, so that they can say that they said something. But even people who have been saying something are not acting in accord with their legal and other obligations. And of course, Israel has systematically killed journalists. So you're seeing more and more reports of people saying there's an increased number of killings, but a decreased number of videos of the carnage, because Israel has systematically killed the messengers. Exactly. You know, that's one way to fix. That's one way to fix.
It's so obvious, you know, images, that has been the modus operandi. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is a unique situation. The amount of journalists, there's all kinds of figures about, you know, the amount of journalists killed in this war than any other world in the history of the world. But it has been brutal, clearly, and it's about shutting down the messenger again. Speaking of our messenger today is Sam Husseini. Every Monday he joins us for what we call Genocide Watch, and it has everything to do with the Israelis' decision, their publicly declared decision, to wipe clean the slate of Gaza and to hell with the people who live there by the millions. Why don't you bring in, we can turn it legal and we can turn it to the United Nations. Why don't you introduce us to our guest, Sam?
Sure. I've had the pleasure of getting to know Rob over the last 2 years. He heads up Code Pink's World Court Project. He lives right near the United Nations, and he has set up meeting after meeting with various delegations trying to get them to actually act, and occasionally he's protested more than occasionally, certainly in front of the U.S. mission to the U.N., but other missions as well, who, you know, proclaim various things but don't act on them. And right now we have, an effort that seems, you know, very, perfunctory to for states to say that they recognize Palestinian state.
Yes.
In order to weasel out of actually doing something to stop the genocide. And you also have a proposal by the French and the Saudis to put in what they call a stabilization force, which is just looks like it would just be another arm of occupation. But I'd love Rob to, you know, break down what he thinks are some of the most important things in terms of various countries and what their stances are, because he's looked at that so closely for quite some time.
Speak to us, Rob Jareski. We'd love to hear from you. You're an attorney.
Sure.
You are based in New York. What's happening at the UN? Does it matter about these announcements from these countries?
Well, you know, recognizing a state that, the recognition of a Palestinian state is, it depends on which state you're, which country is doing it, but they seem to be, some of them continue to be arming the country that is bombing them, that is laying siege to the Palestinian population that's holding 2.3 million people as hostages. It's really quite remarkable that this effort to recognize the Palestinian state just, you know, took off in June with the Saudi French New York declaration, and just was sort of deployed with so much diplomatic muscle and rallied so many people. The UN General Assembly codified effectively the New York Declaration a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, with overwhelming votes. And the New York Declaration, when it was announced in June, it broke out into these working groups on various parts of the to manifest and materialize some of the into committees and working groups, and so Ireland is working with Turkey, and I can't remember the committee they're working on, they're co-chairing, but it's an amazing amount of work. You have to stand back and look at the anemic response of countries around the world observing what we've all observed for now nearly 2 years, which was announced in advance and has been executed in public, and just the response to it by all these countries who can find the time in the last 3 months while the people of Gaza are under siege and starving. It's just astounding. And so, you know, if it were the recognition of statehood, and we'd be, you know, maybe very happy that the Palestinian state, which may, as you know, Francesca Albanese, you know, hopefully described, provide or impose obligations on states to actively respect Palestinian rights to non-interference, territorial integrity, self-defense from illegal occupation, and an end to the genocide. You know, those obligations may be increased, or there might be not an increase in the obligation, but it might be irrefutable that the Palestinian people, they enjoy those rights because they have a state. That was her response in Al Jazeera. But I feel it's just really, you know, it's not imposing the obligations on Israel to actually stop its insanity, you know, to stop using food as a weapon of war, to stop the targeting of civilian infrastructure. We see high-rise tower after high-rise tower with set demolitions. This isn't an active war zone, the way these countries are trying, you know, that the language they use is so infuriating, because there is a distortion of the facts on the ground that we're all witnessing, that is it's a global gaslighting for 20 years. And I'm afraid that this recognition of a Palestinian state is part of that, unfortunately.
I think that's absolutely spot on. And I mean, these countries, as you say, are still trading with Israel. Last time I checked, you know, Turkey is still at least supplying oil. I don't know if that's been overtaken by events. Even South Africa, which filed a genocide convention lawsuit, is apparently still delivering coal to Israel. Last I checked, please correct me if that's been overtaken by events. And meanwhile, you have, and as you say, Ireland, you have some countries, Spain apparently cutting off weapons supplies finally to Israel, but you know, sometimes these countries will make an announcement and then 6 months later will make the same announcement because it wasn't really implemented the first time, and I don't even know if it'll be implemented the second time.
Turkey announced its trade embargo I think over a year ago. We're not going to trade with Israel anymore. And then you learn that they're actually they do two tricks. They send it through third countries, the goods that they described as dual use, and it certainly wasn't all the goods that they were shipping to Israel that were going through third countries. But the other trick they did was they redefined in their trade balance or in their logging of these exports Palestine as the recipient instead of Israel. Just these gimmicks, and you know, there's a game that the media in Israel and in Turkey play, the pro Erdogan media in Turkey and the pro Netanyahu media in Israel, that they decry the other as like a Hitler. Oh, you know, Erdogan says, you know, Netanyahu's a Hitler, and Netanyahu says Erdogan's a Hitler, and they're trading. They're still there. I've seen no end of the oil that's going from Azerbaijan to Ceyhan and then by ship to Israel. You know, that would cut off 40% of domestic oil consumption in Israel. I mean, that's a big threat to cut that off. And I have seen nothing to confirm it. And of course, it would make international news if it actually happened. All Erdogan has to do is cut that spigot off, and I think Israel would be much more likely to stop killing Palestinians and to take the deal to release hostages that Israel's holding for Israel, you know, hostages that Hamas is holding and Islamic Jihad and others. So it's just there are announcements. You know, Ireland, it was selling war bonds. They were the named sort of issuer of war bonds for Israel. And instead of saying we're cutting this off, They gave that authority to Luxembourg. They said, we're going to give that to Luxembourg, because they were feeling such heat domestically, as our country's governments around the world, which is also another part of what the statehood recognition is to sort of take off the pressure valve on governments that have been arming Israel throughout this, or providing diplomatic cover, or trading with Israel with essential goods, tech and hydrocarbons. It's like a way of getting the population to feel like, okay, you know, something good's happening, you know, because we all want something good to happen. We want this horror to end. But it just seems like the way it is, you know, what's happening is not that.
We've discussed on the show before Uniting for Peace, a way for the General Assembly to overcome the U.S. veto and do things like pass a resolution demanding that countries do serious sanctions, as happened in the case of South Africa, or have a protection force. And the president of Ireland even made some remarks a couple of weeks ago, you know, seeming to back that up. And I'm hearing that Colombia might be putting forward such a resolution. Can you tell me your latest thoughts on that, Rob?
Well, it's the pressure on governments that, you know, through visits to missions and meetings with diplomats that we've been able to secure, and then just the protests, have been for a protection force, a bill that would include a number of demands or impose a number of outcomes on from the General Assembly through Uniting for Peace. One would be to call for the creation of a protection force, which would be put in place to protect civilians and the delivery of humanitarian aid, and to preserve evidence of the crimes that are still being committed. Another condition would be a systematic call for economic sanctions and an arms embargo on Israel. A third one would be the establishment of an international tribunal, which the General Assembly is able to do. All of these things the General Assembly is able to demand, and they could call for for instance, with the protection force, countries to provide forces, to provide troops. And I think that all of these demands would contribute, even though we see the international legal architecture that is supposed to, like you said, Sam, prevent genocide. You know, when the World Court announced that there was a risk of irretrievable harm of Palestinian rights that were protected under the Genocide Convention in January of 2024, the international community should have sprung into action to prevent genocide, which the Human Rights Commission just announced is happening late in the day, I would say, after many, many credible scholars and observers had already declared that it was happening. But we don't need it to be happening for it to be, for this treaty to be triggered. And that's what Lemkin, you know, was a student of, not just what happened after 41. He was a student of what happened in 33, the dehumanization of Jews that led to the genocide. And the dehumanization has been, you know, very clear to the media observers who have, like, underscored the erasure of Palestinians in the coverage of what's happening. The hostages get names, they get pictures, they get biographies, and as they should. But the hostages in Israeli jails, Dr. Abu Safiya, I can't remember his name, Bush, I think is his name. He was murdered. He was murdered in captivity. And these are like, you know, Dr. Abu Safiya is the head of the director of a hospital, a pediatrician. Anyhow, you know, Lemkin said the risk of genocide comes from, you know, dehumanization is part of it. And that has to be, you know, so countries should have already taken action. And in January 2024, they've been, as we've all seen, not doing what they need to. And this call for statehood, in some cases, it's conditional. And it's clearly biased and unfair. Hamas cannot take part in any future government, and there must be a demilitarized Palestinian state, right? Belgium imposed the condition for recognition. Well, what about Likud? What about the entire government, including the opposition in the Knesset, that is calling for annexation, which is a war crime? And he's calling for, eradication. The leaders of these parties who are calling for, Amalek. It was the first week of this that we heard the call for genocide. So
yeah, it's been remarkable. I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's very similar to what Macron, French president, you know, he's been getting some media for their French proposal, and he frames it exactly in those terms, in terms of totally eradicating Hamas and telling Israel that, oh, you're being unstrategic in, the world seeing how many people you're killing, basically, without objecting to them actually killing a lot of people. So it's been really remarkable that this is what passes for criticism.
It gives new meaning to the concept of double standard. Listen, we're just about out of time for this segment this week. This is our genocide and our Gaza genocide segment, which we do every week, Genocide Watch on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We thank you, Robert, for joining us. We want you to come back. Sam, you're going to be participating in some media related stuff tomorrow in the context of the United Nations. What are you doing? How can people follow you?
Go to stopgenocide.com. Right now, there's stuff there that allows people to send letters to different countries urging them to do things, and I certainly encourage people to do that. But come tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. Eastern, UN time, New York time, there'll be a live stream of what's happening at the UN General Assembly, and myself and Craig Mochaber and other good folks will be sort of responding in real time to what's being said, sort of doing a live stream, kind of a live C-SPAN, but with, guts to it, responding to and debunking stuff like that. I should also note one last thing, if I might, Dennis,
please.
We didn't have time to get to it, but Trump, Rob works with Code Pink, and Trump just threatened Code Pink with RICO charges.
Yes.
As part of an especially insidious part of going after free speech. And folks should know that I just wrote a really in-depth piece on Larry Ellison, who is a fanatic supporter of the Israeli military, being the key component of the takeover for TikTok, because they pretend that they want to get rid of TikTok because they don't want foreign influence, and now they're handing it over to people who are totally in bed with the Israeli military. So much for that being the pretext. It's just simply that they don't
are they
want
foreigners? I thought they were.
Well, if you listen to Larry Ellison's remarks, I posted them on my webpage. I mean, he talks about Israel and doing all he can for the Israeli military, and this is our state, and all of that. I don't think he's an Israeli citizen, but he certainly talks like an Israeli citizen, and that seems to be his priorities. It's an attempt to prevent people, especially young people, from communicating about Palestine. The ADL last year said we have a Gen Z problem with TikTok, and they solved it they're trying to solve it by gutting TikTok of Palestinian content and making it suppress speaks that's critical of Israel, as most other big tech platforms have done.
Very important point. We thank both of you for joining us on Flashpoints. We'll all be tuning in to the UN tomorrow and listening to what's happening, Sam, as you try and break the barricade, knock down the wall, blocking the flow of information from the people who really need to understand what's going on. That's the American, United States of America, because the U.S. is the funder. It's disgusting.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We'll be back next Monday with this segment. We're going to take a very short break. We're running late. Kevin Pina has been patiently standing by. He's got important news for us. Stay with us. To Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We turn our attention back to Haiti and Venezuela. I think we had the third or the fourth bombing today, Kevin Pina. You've been watching this situation closely. You have some original thoughts on what might be the bigger picture. It might not only be Venezuela, but extremely resource-rich Haiti. Welcome back. What do we need to know about these policies now? We're seeing Trump blow up the boats and talk about the drug trade, but that's not the story.
Well, it's interesting. It's sort of a vaudeville act in many respects. The Trump administration is just trying to throw anything at the wall that will stick against Venezuela. Their main charge, of course, has been that Venezuela is responsible for major drug trafficking in the region. Most experts, security experts I've spoken to, this includes people in Colombia and in Haiti, say that that's simply not true. That, in fact, most of the weapons and drugs that are going directly to Vive Ensemble in Haiti, if you look at a map and you look at Catatumbo, which is south of three other provinces to the north, and then you look at Venezuela to the east, it just doesn't make geographical sense. Of course, the clearest route is directly up, and that's where we know the majority of these boats that have been landing in Haiti and small aircraft that have been flying out of that region and landing in small airfields in Haiti, protected by Vive Ensemble, that's where they're originating, is directly out of Catatumbo and the northern provinces above it in Colombia. And remember, there's five organizations, five really. If you talk about the organizations in Catatumbo, there's no single Colombian cartel called the Catatumbo cartel. You know, there's the old remnants of the ELN, the National Liberation Army. There's FARC, of course, which had waged a armed struggle against the Colombian government for decades. It now has dissidents that are engaged in trying to control the trafficking in the area. There's also the Popular Liberation Army. It's a guerrilla group which demobilized in 1991, but now it's deeply involved in trafficking in the Catatumbo region. Then there's also the Gaitanista, Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, also known as the AGC, or once known as the Gulf Clan. It also has a major foothold in that area in drug trafficking. And then an organization called Los Rostrojos, which emerged from the Norte del Valle cartel. It once controlled most of the smuggling routes into Venezuela, but has since splintered in the 2010s and has had a hard time competing with these other five organizations for control of the cocaine area. And a lot of this is coming from the Colombian army. The Colombian army has never really stopped battling the cartels. They have changed their policy in terms of cocaine eradication, but they've never stopped trying to dislodge these cartels, these organizations that are vying for power and control of the cocaine in the Catatumbo region. So when you hear Trump talking about Venezuela as this major transshipment point, it almost seems as if it's cover. But just this last week, Trump, for the first time, did connect Haiti with cocaine trafficking from Catatumbo, but he insists that rather than coming directly from northern Colombia, it's going through Venezuela, which of course contradicts what the Colombian generals are saying and what Colombian intelligence is saying and what Colombian President Petro, Gustavo Petro, is saying inside of Colombia.
What do you think Trump, in his sort of greedy personal way, corporate connection, what I mean, doesn't that have something to do with how he is treating the region and the potential for extraordinary discoveries of various in the ground gold mines?
Well, you know, there are riches, there are mineral riches in Haiti, but let's just put that aside. Let's talk about the billions of dollars of untraceable cash that goes to Haiti every year. That banking system has operated for decades with impunity, where bankers who were backed by the U.S. in two coups d'etats in 1991 and in 2004 have virtually operated with little oversight while billions of dollars of untraceable cash have gone through those banks. There's never been a call for controlling the oversight of the banks. The DEA has gone in, the CIA has made moves, but nobody's ever called for an actual auditing of Haiti's banking system, and I think for good reason, because it has been a huge drug laundering machine, and it's the worst kept secret in the Caribbean. So, you know, just putting those mineral resources, which you're talking about, aside, there's also billions of dollars of untraceable cash that continues to flow through Haiti today that's at stake. Now, we know that it's no longer just the drug trade that Vivant Somme, the gangs, are involved in. We also know the UN has said that they've been making as much as $100 million a year extorting cargo shipments between the Dominican Republic, wow, and Haiti. You don't put that kind of money under your mattress, Dennis. You don't bury that kind of cash under your couch. Yeah. That kind of cash requires bankers, the collusion of bankers, yeah, in the Dominican Republic and in Haiti to move it. And if that's happening, it has to be happening under the very nose of the Trump administration, who claims that they want to shut down cocaine trafficking in the region. If you really want to shut it down, go after the bankers. Go to the Dominican Republic's banking system and begin investigations. Go to Haiti's bankers that are continuing to operate and begin investigations, and you'll shut it down quick enough. Because that money has to be moved, and somebody is colluding to move that money, because again, you just do not take that kind of money and hide it under your mattress. But you know, Trump is also making some, I think many people are confused and don't know how to make sense. One minute it's about drugs, the next minute it's about take back your prisoners that you released into the United States. He did some Truth Social post, I believe, over the weekend, again one of these late night posting fest that he has by himself, and apparently now he's saying that, you know, one minute it, you know, you've got to stop the drug trafficking, the next minute Maduro's a dictator, we don't see it as legitimate, then in another minute it's like you've got to take back your prisoners that you've released intentionally into the United States, we don't want them here. So, you know, as usual, the Trump administration is throwing crap everywhere to see what will stick to the wall, and yeah, quite frankly, it's just part of the same erratic pattern we've seen here at home. We're seeing applied to Colombia, we're seeing applied to Venezuela, and we're seeing applied to Haiti. In Haiti, they've actually got the U.S. ambassador and the head of communications, Mike Hanke, there, and Wooster, who's the ambassador, actually having what they're calling these coffee clutches, where they're speaking in broken Creole, addressing the gangs, and they're releasing these videos of themselves sort of having this discussion over coffee about how the United States is intention is to really get rid of the gangs, and reiterating that they've got all these rewards for the gang members, when of course this is the same embassy that admitted last year that it's in touch with those very same gangs. They made the statement that of course the U.S. embassy is in touch with the belligerents, because that's how we maintain our security. So for them to offer these rewards for the location of people like Jimmy Cherizer, the former cop who heads Vivant Somme, or Vita Lome, who's right next door to the U.S. Embassy in a neighborhood called Torcel, who they put a $2 million bounty on his head, or L'Amour Saint Jour, who was responsible for the kidnapping of those 17 foreign missionaries a couple years back and actually got away with the ransom, now is showing off his big, beautiful house that he built inside of Haiti in Guadeloupe on TikTok. You know, it's Haitians look at it as ridiculous. They kind of look at it as a sideshow when U.S. embassy officials are releasing these videos and sort of broken Creole. It's not broken Creole. It's Creole, but it's very anglicized pronunciation. It's like foreigners trying to speak their language in an awkward way, and so Haitians just are sort of clowning it. They're not taking the U.S. embassy seriously. They, you know, again, this is also making them highly circumspect about the relationship of their own government to the U.S. government, given that this has gone on so long. More than 1.5 million people displaced. We've seen tens of thousands of people on the run. We've seen thousands of people murdered and killed, homes burned down, entire neighborhoods. And then in the middle of this, the United States is still pushing Haiti, and the Haitian government is pretending that they're going to hold elections. You know, where are you going to put ballot boxes? Where, how are you going to distribute ballots?
Well, they got rid of that. That's such a fallacy, Kevin.
And build a system for people to be able to have a democratic ballot in that kind of environment. It's all just ludicrous. And to add to it is this dimension of Venezuela and now trying to connect it to Haiti and the cartels, when quite clearly everyone knows that's not what's really going on here.
Right. And everyone knows what the United States thinks about self-determination, real self-determination in Haiti, because it came close through Jean-Bertrand Aristide, so close to something that looked like the beginning of a democracy, but the United States government, as always, wouldn't have it. We're out of time, Kevin, but we always appreciate you keeping a spotlight on the region, on what's happening in Haiti, and we're going to keep an eye on this Venezuela, Haiti. What really is Trump up to? What does he want to get out of this?
Thanks. I'm trying to get one of these security experts to actually come on the record and come on our show soon. So
let's have some fun with that. I'd like to do that. Thanks, Kevin Pena, Senior Producer for Flashpoints. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Short break, back with Code Pink. You heard governments after them, too, and we got one of their important local effective organizers to join us in one moment. Stay with us. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we are happy to welcome back Cynthia Papermaster. She's the sort of one of the coordinators here in the Bay Area, and she has been doing some traveling lately and really devoting large amounts of time over many months trying to restrain and call attention to what we do a lot of talking about, and that's the U.S.-funded genocide. Cynthia, welcome back to Flashpoints. We heard in our last segment with Sam Husseini, that Code Pink has got the attention of the United States government. What's going on there?
Oh, hi, Dennis. Thank you for having me. Yeah, Code Pink confronted Trump and many in his administration at a restaurant in Washington, D.C. last week, and that video clip went viral. Trump didn't like it very much, so he's going to go after us. It's not funny, but I'm sorry. RICO charges? I'm not sure that he'll get anywhere with that. But, you know, his Justice Department is just the opposite of unjust.
We'll keep an eye on that, because we want you to be safe. We want to know what's going on. But what's going on for you right now? I know that you got a lot of things in the fire, and some of it actually is poetry.
Right. I'll mention three different things in rapid succession. On Wednesday, poets to Padilla and Schiff. The world cries out, let Gaza live, block the bombs, protect journalists. And there's a long list of fantastic poets who are going to be reading on Wednesday at 5 p.m. at Senator Schiff's San Francisco office, which is One Post Street, and Code Pink is joining them over there. Maxine Hahn Kingston, the Veterans Writers Group, a lot of veterans poets. Jenny Lim, San Francisco Poet Laureate. Devorah Major, third SF Poet Laureate. And the list goes on and on. This is going to be a great gathering, again, at 5 p.m. at One Post, Senator Schiff's office. And, of course, Schiff takes about $6 million from the pro-Israel lobby. He has not voted against weapons to Israel. We need to keep confronting him. So that's happening on Wednesday. And I'll just mention really quickly a couple other things. On Friday, if people are listening in New York or want to go to New York, Benjamin Netanyahu will be appearing at the United Nations on Friday. And there's a gathering at Times Square at 9 a.m. to arrest him, you know, to talk about arresting him, stop the genocide and sanction Israel. So people, if you're in New York or can get to New York, you want to do that at 9 a.m. on Friday. I can't believe that Netanyahu's going to speak at the United Nations. The nerve. Seriously.
I don't think they're letting Palestinians into the country at the moment, but I guess he's welcome. There seems to be a problem there.
Well, you know, many United Nations missions are recognizing Palestine as a state now. I don't remember how many. It's over 100. I think I want to say maybe 140 nations. But Netanyahu says there will never be a Palestinian state. So, he's pretty much alone now, with the United States, of course, partnering. It's beyond outrageous. It's just unbelievable. One more thing I'll mention real quick.
Yep.
You know, the Oakland Airport, it's been discovered Oakland Airport, commercial airport, is shipping F-35 lethal fighter jet parts to Israel. And there was a port shutdown on Friday to try to stop that. It was wonderful. I was there, and there were maybe about 300 people there. There's a petition on Code Pink's website. Nearly 5,000 people have signed it. I'd like to encourage people to go there, codepink.org/airport, and sign that petition. Let's tell Oakland Port Authority and the airport to stop contributing, stop being complicit in this genocide. Right here in Oakland, California. It's unbelievable. Let's stop that.
Okay. That's an important announcement from Code Pink. Please, as always, you're always welcome. Please keep us posted
okay.
What's on the agenda, and we'd like to get a visit. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dennis.
It's our pleasure, Cynthia Papermaster of Code Pink, Bay Area, and she's been busy. We are keeping busy here at KPFA Flashpoint Pacifica Radio. We're going to come back to the genocide, after we take a break, we're going to be joined again by Anita Barros, who has been keeping track of the genocide day by day, poem by poem. Today is day 717 of the genocide, and Anita will be joining us with 717 poem based on the genocide. Stay with us.
listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Honored to welcome back to these airwaves Anita Barros. Anita is a poet. She's a translator of Rilke. She's the mom of Nora Barros Friedman. And she has been writing a poem every single day of the genocide. And today is 717, day 717 of the Gaza genocide. And Anita joins us with 717, the poem, and a few others. We've been keeping track with her and always are honored and moved by the visits. Anita, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis. I'm very, very glad to be here. Day 717 is quite something. I made a typo yesterday when I first sent out my poems. I wrote 417, and then I looked at it and I thought, oh my God, 417 was a long time ago, and that felt like a lot. Or 416 yesterday.
Right.
But here we are. Here we are. And I will read day 717, which I finished just a little while ago. Day 717, Gaza City. Was this the last day of your life? The last hour? No way to know. Explosions everywhere. Look around at everything you love that still remains. Your mother, a sister. Your two books that you've carried from one displacement to the next. Look at the sky, the shadows of trees, the charred grasses. Look around at the earth about to yield to autumn. Some leaves that may mulch, whether or not you're here, into richer soil.
We appreciate the poetry because it helps us stay human. I feel very strongly that the phrase "tell it like it is crucial here, because what's happening is beyond belief. People are becoming hardened to it. It's taking a backseat to other, in comparison, ridiculous things. And yet it's a daily mass murder with weaponry that the United States of government, U.S. tax dollars, are funding. And nobody's talking about any end in sight. So you writing these poems and documenting every day means all the more to us. I know you've got a few more for us.
Yeah. No, it feels so important to be doing it. It's, you know, so many people, as you say, are looking away, and it feels so essential to not look away, to not forget. This is day 716, yesterday. Their voices are loud now, the voices of those whose bodies were crushed, burned, shredded to pieces, lost, starved, exploded, eviscerated, turned to dust, merged with the dust of the air, the ground. Their voices are loud, are clear. They are calling to those they loved, to those they never knew. They are crying out to the oceans, the rivers, the animals. In all the dialects of the earth, they are shouting, justice, and stop, and enough, and a billion times more than enough. At times, they are singing. They are singing songs of mourning and rage and tenderness. Their songs thread the savage land with everything they will never live. Listen, listen, listen. It just feels so essential to keep listening. I'll read a couple more from this weekend. This is day 714. Chase the food as it falls, parachuted from the sky. Chase it across the charred field. Chase it into the sea. It's only a sack of flour, a few cans of diced chicken, but see if you can get there before the others. An old man is trying to run with his cane. A boy stumbles with weakness. You pick up three cans, give each of them one, keep one for yourself, knowing it won't feed your family, knowing you'll have to return tomorrow, risk one more time the sniper's bullet, the airdrop falling on top of you, crushing the bones in your body that haven't eroded yet. The cruelty of those airdrops, the absolute sadism of them.
Right. And it really, and it fits that notion of food as and starvation as ultimate weapons of war. And we see it in the bones as U.S. policy makes it possible for this kind of slaughter. And how everybody knows that the Israelis are controlling the calories that get into the bodies of Palestinians, controlling them in such a way that the concept is that maybe they'll have enough energy to leave Gaza when the Israelis decide to open the gates.
Right, exactly. And they've been counting the calories for years. It didn't start on October 7th, 2023. They have increased the starvation. They've amplified it so that it's absolute starvation. But until then, they deliberately figured out how many calories somebody could survive on without dying, but not really thrive. And they refuse to let certain foods in, and then they would let those foods in, and they would refuse to let others in. And, you know, you could have cinnamon but not cardamom. Outrageously absurd policies that are just, you know, people toying with other people's lives. It's horrific.
We have time for one more if you jump into it.
Great. Okay. This is day 715. You wake to a quiet sky. For a moment, you try to remember your world as it was before. Your mother alive, your small brothers whispering to each other in their beds. A breeze from the sea moves the sides of the tent back and forth. If you close your eyes, you can try to pretend it's your sister's breathing, still asleep. You try to recall how your days would unfold. How your friends would meet you at your door, how you'd walk with them to school, sharing secrets, anxious about exams. You feel the hard ground beneath you. Try to remember cool sheets, softness of pillows. Now, in the distance, explosions. The sky flashes light, not from the sun. You try not to count your dead.
That is the voice of the poet, psychotherapist, Anita Barros. Anita, we have 15 seconds. How are your students doing? I forgot to ask you. You have students on the ground in Gaza now.
I have students on the ground in Gaza City. They keep reassuring me that they're okay, but I think they're just trying to reassure me. They're still alive. That's all I can say. I know they're starving. I know they're existing on sips of water and the odd can of something that they can scrounge up.
And what they can get from staying alive through their own consciousness And that's where the poetry comes in, and we thank you for that. Anita Barrow is writing a poem every day of this genocide on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We'll be back.
KBOO, Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons